From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Ambassador James Jeffrey, former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq and Turkey, currently Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he focuses on U.S. diplomatic and military strategy in the Middle East, with an emphasis on Turkey, Iraq, and Iran. In addition to his service as ambassador in Ankara and Baghdad, Ambassador Jeffrey served as assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor in the George W. Bush administration. We'll talk with Ambassador Jeffrey about a range of U.S. foreign policy issues, such as the rise of Iran in the Middle East, as well as President Trump's controversial decision to recognize Jerusalem as the official capital of Israel and how that might affect Middle East peace talks. Ambassador Jeffrey joins us at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Carol.
Well, Ambassador Jeffrey, let's talk about this decision by President Trump to declare his intention to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Now, that's a controversial move, which has maybe pleased the Israeli government, but certainly alienated the Palestinians, most of the Arab world, and, of course, our European partners. What's your take on this decision and the timing of it?
Technically, it's a symbolic application of a symbolic position. The United States Congress has recognized Israel's capital to be Jerusalem since 1995 and been at least officially pushing the administration to do so as well and to establish the embassy there. There is no indication that President Trump has any plans in the near future to move the embassy there. But by making this symbolic gesture, he is, as you said, pleasing the Netanyahu government. The problem is this gives people in the region, in the Islamic world, another reason to question where this president is taking relations with the Islamic world, because this is seen as something that undercuts the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians, and to some degree calls into question, although I don't think that's the intent of the president, the Islamic nature of some of the shrines and some of the city itself, which, of course, is a shared tradition of the three monotheic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
And of course, President Trump has declared his interest in brokering peace in the Middle East. And this particular move seems to undermine that. So it seems contradictory on the one hand to declare Jerusalem as the capital, but on the other hand say he wants to promote peace, knowing full well that this has certainly alienated the very partners which are needed for the peace process in the Arab world and the Palestinians, of course, as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Carol. But it's more than and a little bit different than this. First of all, the peace process, despite the efforts by Jared Kushner and the president's ambassador in Israel, really have not gone anyplace since the late Obama administration. And this idea that the Palestinians declare the United States no longer an unbiased broker, I'm sorry, if you want to talk with somebody who can get the Israelis to do anything, that address is Washington, not Brussels, not Tehran, not anyplace else. The biggest problem with this, first, is there's always a risk that this will ignite violence between the Palestinians and the Israeli Authority. We have seen that repeatedly with Israel in 2000, with Ari Sharon's visit there. But we've seen this repeatedly with metal detectors just a year or so ago in Jerusalem, led to another outburst of violence. So I'm very concerned about that. But the underlying problem is, at a time when Iran is scoring victory and victory across the Middle East, this undercuts the anti-Iranian alliance that the president is trying to put together with Israel, with Turkey, with the Arab states, with the United States, and with even some Shia in places like Iraq. That's the problem we have right now.
Indeed. Well, that leads me to move on to Saudi Arabia, because, of course, Saudi Arabia is deeply concerned about the rise of Iran in the region, whether in Syria, whether in Iraq, whether in Yemen. And we recently saw the back and forth with respect to Lebanon and the rise, of course, of Hezbollah and Saudi Arabia's concern about that. So let's turn to Saudi Arabia and look at how you see Saudi Arabia, and particularly the new crown prince's position, his attempt to consolidate power in the kingdom.
I met with the crown prince a little over a year ago before he became the crown prince. At the time, he was a deputy crown prince, but we could see the writing on the wall. He is the new essential leader of Saudi Arabia, and thus in many respects, at least the Sunni Arab world of the Middle East. This reform program has inspired many people in Saudi Arabia, but also in places like Kuwait as well, who watch the actions of the Saudi government, of course, in the various media. He's seen as somebody who's trying to modernize the region, and that has a tremendous appeal to young people. You remember the history, not just the Arab Spring of 2011, but we had similar manifestations in 2013 in Istanbul, and we had in 2009 in Iran. Also, an outbreak of protest. The thirst for political relevance and inclusion on the part of particularly of young people, that is very, very broad in the Middle East. He's tapped into that, and that may help him. But the other thing is, Saudi Arabia may or may not succeed with his program of economic reform to move the economy in the country away from dependence on oil, but it has no other choice. With oil prices having gone from over $100 to somewhere between right now around 60 to down below 40 over the past 4 years, countries like Saudi Arabia cannot continue to survive on an oil-based economy. There isn't just enough to cover their deficit, to cover their expenditures for their own population. So this is an existential struggle he has to reform the country. At the same time, however, he's facing an existential threat from Iran. It isn't just in faraway Syria. It's the risk, for example, that the Iranian allies, the Houthis, next door in Yemen, who just fired a rocket into Riyadh, almost hitting the airport, that they may develop exactly what Israel faces in Lebanon on its northern border. Hundreds of thousands of missiles and rockets, ever more long range, ever more accurate, that can take down the entire Saudi infrastructure and military capabilities in a couple of hours. I don't think the Saudis are going to allow that to happen, which is why we have the crisis in Yemen right now.
Speaking now of the Crown Prince's foreign policy, many analysts have been quite critical of it, notwithstanding the need to counter Iran in the region. How would you characterize Saudi Arabia's strategy and tactics in terms of countering Iran, especially in Yemen? Some say they have too much of a heavy hand, so many civilian casualties that perhaps Riyadh is not taking the right approach, and then the recent kerfuffle in Lebanon, where Saudi Arabia is believed to have pressured Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri to resign. Then he actually reneged on that. He is now back in Beirut. So do you think they're clumsy with respect to the very important need to counter Iran? How effective has it been?
That is a very interesting question, and I'm going to give you a very unorthodox answer. Our ally, Saudi Arabia, is clumsy, has gone off on its own against Qatar in some degree with the Hariri incident in Lebanon. Clearly what's happened in Yemen, be it the civilian casualties, as you mentioned, or whatever Saudi role was played in former President Saleh rebelling against the Houthis, and then he and his whole army getting destroyed in Sana'a over the past several days. That's all true, just like it's all true that the last American administration ignored the Iranian threat, and this current one, while it is vocally aggressive towards Iran, hasn't done very much. But the real problem is Iran. And the critics will give lip service to, yes, we have to contain Iran. Look what happened just alone in Syria. Nobody can turn away from the tragedy there. The use of chemical weapons, half a million, up to half a million people killed and such. But the same critics, and I'm part of that group of people in Washington that comments on and writes about foreign policy, will immediately react in all kinds of negative ways to anybody who tries to do anything about it. Let's look at it from the point of view of the Saudis. They see what Israel is facing with these huge rocket and missile arsenals that Hezbollah has on Israel's northern border. They know that the Iranians are trying to do the same thing with the Houthis, also trying to cut off shipping in the straits off of the Red Sea, which is a critical communications artery for oil and other transportation between Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. This is all very dangerous stuff. Have they slaughtered civilians? Absolutely. The casualty level, according to the UN, however, is 10,000. The Saudis look at that and say, hey, in Syria, it's 40 times that. What has the UN or the international community done about that? They're beating up on us because we actually have to pay attention to them. The Iranians just ignore it, and nobody criticizes them. Nobody criticizes the Russians as they level the entire historic ancient city of Aleppo, and the world just turns away and then attacks us Saudis. I have a certain sympathy for the Saudis. That said, what they're doing is not contributing in a significant way to stopping Iran. That requires American leadership and American guidance and a much more active American role, and we haven't seen that so far.
Well, that actually leads me to want to talk to you about Syria, but let's do that after we take a short break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador James Jeffrey, former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq and Turkey, currently Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is a think tank here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a big shout out to Umar Zada. He's a loyal listener from Bunarwal, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We'll back to our special guest, Ambassador James Jeffrey. And we were just about to talk about Syria before we went to the break. And the reason I want to do that, Ambassador Jeffrey, is because, as you said earlier, it's a terrible tragedy promulgated principally by Russia and Iran-backed Assad government. Iran and Russia have stepped up their support for the murderous regime of Bashar al-Assad, and we're seeing them on the rise, which leads me to ask you about the U.S. role, because some analysts say that the United States perhaps could have and should have done more, that we are actually inadvertently, perhaps, strengthening the Iranian and Russian position in Syria. How do you see that?
Absolutely. The United States, and I experienced this when I was in Iraq in 2012, decided in reaction to what it saw as the mistakes of the Bush administration under President Obama, pivoted away from the region, particularly away from Syria and Iraq. That left a vacuum. The vacuum was filled first by Iran, which pushed its surrogates, Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq and President Assad in Syria, to take a very hardline position against the Sunni Arabs and, to some degree, the Sunni Kurds, who together make up a majority of Syria and Iraq. Well, the problem is, if the United States in the global security system, or the Middle East version of it, does not deal with threats such as Iran, just like we dealt with the threat of ISIS, we dealt with the threat of Saddam, then local people are going to turn to whoever will defend them. And that whoever turned out to be the al-Qaeda offshoot that we now know is ISIS. ISIS grew from a small gang that I was having to deal with in 2012 in Mosul, the last place they had a foothold in Iraq in 2012, to an army of 35,000 controlling 9 million people with a $1 billion budget in 2014. That was a reaction by the Sunni Arabs of Iraq and Syria to oppression and terror by those two governments. And that will happen again. We've now defeated ISIS, but we've left a vacuum. Iran is rushing with its surrogates to fill into that vacuum in Iraq and Syria. And the United States is still, in the last month, trying a bit more effectively to figure out how it can stay on and counter that. But it still does not have a broadly laid out and well-communicated game plan. Are we going to keep our troops on in Syria? With which local allies? If it's the Syrian Kurds, what do we do about Turkey, which sees them with good reason as opposed to Turkey, as allies of the Turkish terrorist PKK? What are we going to do in Iraq, which does have a largely Shia Arab government that is quite sympathetic to Iran? Can we stay on there? How do we counter Iran in both of these countries? That's the question that the administration is wrestling with right now. I'm not sure it's come up with a good answer yet.
Well, again, just as we discussed with respect to the Middle East peace process, having declared our intention to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, doesn't it seem that the U.S. position in Syria is also a bit contradictory? Because while we say, that is the United States say, that we're against the murderous Bashar al-Assad regime and its Iranian-backed proxies and Russia, we also hear President Trump say, well, we could work with Russia in Syria, but that doesn't quite sound coherent because Russia is really on the side of Bashar al-Assad and maybe, if not totally with the Iranians, at least tacitly cooperating with them, to back Bashar al-Assad against the few remaining Syrians who are trying to replace Bashar al-Assad with some sort of democratic government and a much more inclusive one.
Exactly. As my colleague at the Washington Institute, Dennis Ross, just wrote in the Wall Street Journal, for an administration, the Trump administration, that tries to tear up everything Barack Obama has done in Syria, President Trump is making the same mistake that President Obama and Secretary Kerry made, relying on the Russians. Now, to some degree, they are right that the Russians do not want to see Iran overrun the Middle East. And thus, there is a certain division of interest between Iran and Russia, at least theoretically. But on a daily basis, both Iran and Russia want to do two things. Anchor the Assad regime because it advances both of their interests, and destroy the American-led regional security order that has kept the region more or less together since 1973. Iran wants to destroy it and replace it with an Iranian hegemonic design. Russia wants to destroy it, just like it wants to do this in Europe, to replace it with the 19th century, competing great and semi-great powers. That's Putin's dream. He's made that very clear. The problem is, neither of these things are acceptable to us. We have a legal basis to challenge the Assad regime. It's UN Resolution 2254. Given the horror of that war, the huge casualties, the waves of refugees that have destabilized Europe, most recently the Merkel government, Brexit potentially was affected by that, certainly the French elections, the rise of Le Pen to compete for the presidency. All of these are manifestations to some degree of either the refugee flows emanating from Syria or the terrorist attacks that also emanated from ISIS from Syria that was produced by the Sunni reaction to the Iranian surrogates. So on that basis, 2254, the UN resolution, establishes that the international community and the neighborhood have an interest in the internal composition of the Syrian state, because that state has shown to be malignant to its own population, killing them by the thousands with chemical weapons, but also to the region and to the international community. So we have a right to engage. It's international law under what we call Chapter 7, which is legally binding UN resolution. And we have forces on the ground. The Turks have forces on the ground inside Syria. We have a basis to leverage our ACEs, which include our forces on the ground, which include the possibility of blocking reconstruction of Syria, let the Russians and Iranians put it back together, in order to get some kind of a compromise. That's the hope. But the Russians aren't going to do a favor for us. They're only going to stand up to Iran and do some kind of compromise if it is clear that the alternative is they're going to be in a messy, long-term military stalemate with us and our surrogates on the ground.
And of course, they're always ready to veto any UN resolution on Syria.
They are, but for one reason or another, they accepted 2254, and that's the basis that we have to hold their feet to the fire to.
But the United States has to have the political will to enforce it.
That's exactly the point, Carol. The problem is, again, we get back to all of the critics who say, yes, we have to contain Iran, but anytime anybody does anything, they wring their hands about instability. Look at poor Lebanon with the Saudis pressuring Prime Minister Hariri to at least temporarily resign. There's no way, as somebody who's tried to do it on the ground in Iraq for years, there's no way you can stand up to Iran without promoting violence, instability, and uncertainty, and leaving conflicts open until you can get them to cry uncle or at least seek a compromise solution. The story of Syria and Assad is nobody made them do that, so they didn't have to seek a compromise. They could seek a total victory over the bodies of hundreds of thousands of Syrian civilians. And that's what we're going to see more of in the Middle East if somebody doesn't stand up to them.
Ironically, President Trump actually just continued, in a sense, the policy of Barack Obama with regard to Syria by, in a sense, abdicating influence to both Iran and Russia. But let's move on now to Iraq, another one of your specialties. You were ambassador to Iraq. We're seeing lots of both stability and instability, pretty much the defeat of ISIS, basically, having cleared them out of Mosul and other places. But we also have now instability because of the Kurds who tried to have a referendum on independence, which did not turn out well, which then prompted Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to sort of crack down, move into Kirkuk, the city that Kurds see as the potential capital of a future independent or autonomous Kurdistan. I mean, where do things stand in Iraq? And in addition, Iran certainly wields quite a bit of influence in Baghdad as well.
Well, to start off, since 2014, the big story has been ISIS's control of most of the Sunni Arab third of Iraq. In a long battle, with heroic efforts by Iraqi central government troops and Kurdish Peshmerga, but organized and led by an effective American coalition and American airstrikes and some American troops on the ground, ISIS has been totally defeated inside Iraq. The problem is, again, it leaves a vacuum. Into that vacuum came Masoud Barzani and the Kurdistan regional government in the north. He wanted to break out at that time because he was afraid that with ISIS gone, that would create a new vacuum, Iran would run in, and you would see the Lebanization of Iraq. Barzani wanted no part of that. But his action was very, very amateurish, and it did not take into consideration that neither the United States nor Turkey is willing to accept an independent Kurdistan in the breakup of Iraq, because that would give, on a platter, the rest of Iraq to Iran, and we're talking about Iraq alone has two-thirds of Saudi Arabia's oil reserves. Combined with Iran's oil reserves, which are roughly the same, and you would now have the biggest oil and gas producer in the Middle East would not be Saudi Arabia, it would be the Iranian-Iraqi alliance. So there's good reason not to go along with Barzani. The problem is we didn't work close enough with Barzani, and we didn't basically made clear to him that we would not allow Iran to take over all of Iraq. Instead, we told him, you've got to work with the Abadi government. All well and good, but the Abadi government is under the influence of Iran to some degree. So Barzani made a mistake.
Promulgating this referendum.
By promulgating this referendum. And again, it opened the door. Abadi had to react, but who rushed in at the very front? The Iranian-backed militias and General Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Quds Force, who basically on the ground started negotiating deals with some of the Kurds and encouraging military action that went beyond what the Abadi government wanted to do. And again, a big step forward on the Lebanization of Iraq. That's the problem we have now in Iraq.
So you're critical of the U.S. position to some extent because we could have done more to prevent what just happened.
We tried, of course, but we tried only with sticks, telling Barzani, who we've worked with since 1991 and helped create that entity, the Kurdistan Regional Government, which is a huge success in many respects. We basically told him, we'll abandon you if you do this. We didn't say, if you don't do this, if you play the game with us, with Baghdad, here's what we will promise you. We never did that. We basically spouted the same words that I and others have used when we're in Iraq, but none of us in the Iraqis certainly don't believe that, well, this is a democratic parliamentary system and your rights as Kurds will be protected. Nobody believes that. We have, just like in Syria, decided that containing Iran is Russia's job. We've decided in Iraq containing Iran is Prime Minister Abadi's job. My fear is he wants to do that, I'm sure, as do many Iraqis, including Iraqi Shia, but they're not capable of doing that any more than the Christians, the Sunni Arabs, or the Druze of Lebanon were able, and some of the Shia of Lebanon, the Amal party, were able to curb Hezbollah. It is very, very hard to balance the Iranians and their surrogates in a country if you don't have a powerful outside force that can take on the Iranians. And if we're not going to play that road, nobody will.
Indeed. So what we have in Iraq really is a Kurdish referendum which failed to gain any rights for the Kurds, and instead it led more to a diminishment of their own power and territory. And on the upside, the ISIS in Iraq, at least militarily, has been severely diminished. Well, speaking of Iran, I'd like to get your view and your position with respect to the Trump administration's decertification of the Iran deal. Now, that may sound positive for those who want to curtail Iran's hegemony. But other analysts say the decertification might actually lead to greater instability. How do you see the decertification of the Iran nuclear deal and its effect on Iran's influence in the region and ability to do even more harm?
Well, in the region, it was seen as a blow against Iran because Iran has used this agreement, and there's a whole history to this agreement. This agreement basically legitimized Iran as a state, as a legitimate member in good standing of the UN, despite what it was doing in Syria and everything else. That's the thing Barack Obama did not make clear to all of us. And that's the thing that the Republicans, at least in the Senate, sensed when they passed this act, the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, which is exactly what the president basically decertified under those terms. He didn't stop American compliance with the JCPOA, with the Iran Nuclear Agreement. What he's done is, and it is, was the right thing to do, is to call into question the assumptions that were made with that agreement. That the problem with the international community in Iran was all about Iran was trying to get nuclear weapons, was trying to create mischief in the region because it was under pressure from the West, because it felt that America might invade it. And it refers to 1953, the overthrow of Mossadegh by American CIA and British intelligence officials and that kind of thing. Barack Obama bought into that, and his belief was that if you can show we trust Iran and welcome them into the international community with this agreement, Iran would start behaving, or at least would move in that direction. Instead, it saw this as a green light to accelerate its predator behavior throughout the region. And that means that it's fine for President Trump to point out how this agreement was misused, and also the agreement has some flaws. In a nutshell, they are the missile regime, which isn't even in the agreement, but in a cover UN resolution. Secondly, the commitment, which is incredible. I mean, everybody missed this, including me at the time. There's a commitment for the EU and the United States to rebuild the Iranian economy, to help them in technical, energy, scientific, in financial areas to improve their economy. Why? What have they done to deserve that? This was supposed to be an agreement about centrifuges and the amount of enriched uranium you could have. The reason is the Iranians stuffed that in there to make the point we no longer are accountable for anybody. It was all about us being 6 weeks away from a nuclear weapon. It wasn't about our behavior in the region. That's what Trump is trying to deal with, and so far, so good.
Of course, there's so many sides to any one particular issue, and other analysts might say, well, by decertifying the Iran nuclear deal, it just will encourage Iran to throw away any constraints on its intention to acquire nuclear weapons, and it'll still create mischief in the region. Other analysts have said that there's nothing about the so-called nuclear agreement that would have prevented the United States from punishing Iran for its mischievous and very aggressive behavior in the region. In other words, the Iran nuclear agreement is about the nuclear deal and not about its nefarious behavior. And the United States and other actors can certainly curtail or combat Iran in the region without having violated the deal. But that didn't really happen.
Right. And I have some sympathy for these critics, but, and it's a subtle point. But to start with your last point, the Obama administration could have done something about Iran's mischief in the region.
Particularly in Syria.
Particularly in Syria or in Yemen, but it did nothing. In fact, it started pulling back precision-guided munitions for the Saudi Air Force over Yemen. And we know about the Red Line and its other activities in Syria, how little it did there. Instead, it looked to the outside observers that regardless of what that president and the administration said, that they were, if not embracing Iran's role in the region. The president once said that Saudi Arabia should share the region with Iran, but were afraid to do anything against Iran because it might trash the legacy of the Obama administration, which is the nuclear deal. And again, the nuclear deal is more than just about nuclear capabilities. The agreement itself contains language that requires the U.S. and Europe to assist the economic development of Iran. That's not a nuclear thing.
Ambassador James Jeffrey is a former U.S. ambassador to Iraq and Turkey, currently a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Mr. Ambassador, thank you for coming in, sharing your terrific insights on so many important areas and regions. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.